Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist. We're on the air today at broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant in downtown Bushwick on the Heritage Radio Network. And today is the solstice. That was last week. So today is almost the New Year's, and we're going to talk about a strange topic today. We're going to talk about Henry Hudson. Now, why are we talking about Henry Hudson? Because in 1609, Henry Hudson, in quotes, discovered the Hudson River. Of course, it wasn't called the Hudson River. It had a different name by the people who lived here, the Lenni Lenape Indians and some of the other Indian tribes who inhabited this area. They didn't call it that. They had a name for it called the River That Flows Both Ways. So we'll talk about that also. But first, I'd like to make a few little announcements. If you have any questions about any of the things on this program or any of the programs, there's a number to call in. It's 718-497-2128. Yeah, any questions at all. And if they're about my program, then Jack, my producer, will get them to me and I'll answer them on another show. Okay, the next thing I want you to know that if you want to get any information about the Heritage Radio Network, you can go online and go to info@heritageradionetwork.com and you will... We'll try to answer your questions. And one more announcement I'd like to make is my daughter Erica, who has a terrific program called Why We Cook. And at this time of the year, if you want to get good advice on recipes and things to make for the holidays, her program is terrific. And I think her program is broadcast on Tuesday nights. So you can check on that because now we have a schedule of programs listed on the radio network, and remember, everything is archived, and you can get any program that you want to listen to anytime, and you can even download it on your iPod and take it with you when you go traveling or whatever. So our sponsor today is TechServe, and now we'll get back to Henry Hudson. Okay, so Henry Hudson was a 17th century man in search of a 15th century dream, and I'll tell you why I say that right away. His employer was Holland. He worked for Holland. And Holland would soon be in its golden age, offering the world things like Rembrandt, the famous painter. The microscope was invented by Van Leeuwenhoek. He was Dutch or in Holland. And the stock exchange, believe it or not, the Dutch invented the stock exchange. But not as Hudson and his sponsors had hoped, a river through North America leading to China. In those days, we had been trading with people in the Far East, in China and India and places like that. And the only way to get there and back was along the spice route, which was this overland route that went through the Middle East and probably took a year or two to do. Or there were other ways to get there. But the dream was to get a direct route that went west of Europe and somehow through the New World, as they called it, to get to China. A water route to China, to the Chinese trade, replacing the long, arduous Silk Route, was a great dream of the Renaissance time. This was the beginning of the Renaissance. The only alternatives ever found was in 1499, when Vasco da Gama, I'm sure you'll remember these names from school, but you probably won't remember what these guys were famous for, because all these Portuguese and Spanish explorers. So Vasco da Gama in 1499 sailed from Portugal and went around Africa to the Indian Ocean. So picture that, you know, where Portugal is on, right next to Spain. He went south along the coast of Africa, all the way down and around and up into the Indian Ocean. So that was a pretty long trip to get to the Indies, as they call it. All of the westward passages of exploration had ended in failure, with endless landmasses standing in between Europe and China. John Cabot, who was an early English explorer, was stopped by Canada in the north. He went from England directly west. He thought that there was a route that he could find. But All he found was Canada, and everything was pretty frozen. Verrazano was stopped by the United States further south. Okay, so we think of Verrazano and the Verrazano Bridge. Well, Verrazano was an explorer. He was on the same mission. They were all looking for a route to Cathay, as they called China. Columbus was stopped by Central America in the middle, and, you know, the islands in the Caribbean, he went around those, but when he got to the land, it was Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Mexico. So he couldn't get through that way. And Magellan showed that it was a hopelessly long way around South America to the south. Just picture sailing down on a small sailing ship from Europe across the Atlantic, down the coast, all the way down past Brazil and Argentina and all the way around the bottom of South America. It was almost in Antarctica, and he found that you could go around the southern tip of South America into the Pacific. But that was a terrible route. Only one idea still held any possibility, and that was a passage through the Arctic waters, going north instead of going south. And so Hudson was essentially an Arctic explorer. In fact, he was a failed Arctic explorer. On his first voyage for the British, he sailed straight north, attempting to travel beyond the ice and down the other side of the globe. So if you picture in your mind going for Britain, going north, and what would he hit? He would hit the area around the North Pole, which is a huge, huge, huge ice cap. Okay, there's no land at the North Pole. It's all ice and snow, and he couldn't get up around the North Pole. Okay, the plan was geographically astute, but meteorologically absurd, and he was stopped by ice. And he was stopped at the point he could go no further. His 70-foot wooden vessel was only 600 miles short of Robert Perry's 1909 achievement, reaching the North Pole. So he got pretty far north, but he was stopped by the ice. And remember, they were using wooden ships in those days, which were pretty good, but they were nowhere like the steel-hulled icebreakers that we have now. And even these icebreakers get stuck if the ice is too thick. So they can't go any further. So, that business of Perry and the North Pole? We'll save that for another day, because that's an interesting story. Because in our Museum of Natural History, we have this huge meteorite called the Cape York meteorite that Perry brought back. And that's a great story, too, but we'll save that for another time. Okay, so his second voyage, heading northeast over Russia, was also stopped by the ice. At this point, his British sponsor, the Muscovy Company, dropped him, and they thought it was impossible. A new idea came along. In the early 17th century, Captain John Smith, who was a handsome, legendary guy, a big ladies' man, an adventurer, famous for his conquest both militarily and sexual, was the great proponent of European settlement in North America. He charted the coastline. I mean, he came along the coast and he mapped it, reported on his findings, and pitched North America to any Englishman who would listen to him. He was to play a role in the promoting of Britain's two leading North American colonies, Virginia and Massachusetts. So if you remember from your school days, there was a settlement in Jamestown, Virginia, and there was one in Massachusetts, and we know all about that with the Pilgrims and all that. But John Smith was the first one to chart the coast and discover it. So Hudson knew Smith, and they corresponded in 1608. Listen to that date, 1608, by which time four-fifths of Smith's 1607 Virginia settlers had already died. They died of a lot of diseases. They didn't know how to survive in the New World, and they did a thing that was ridiculous. They put their Jamestown settlement in a swamp, and a lot of them died of malaria and yellow fever. Okay, so there was a growing belief that North America was uninhabitable in the winter. But we all know that there were Native Americans living there who knew how to take care of themselves and survive the winters and not live in swamps where there were yellow fever and malaria. Okay, so, but Smith's contagious enthusiasm never faltered. He was a good salesman. He said, boy, North America is a great place and it has great treasures, and we should settle there. Okay, so not only did he believe in North American settlements, this entire debate taking place as if no one else was already living here. Of course, they knew about the Native Americans, but they just ignored them. But his maps and letters to Hudson promoted an alternative to the theory that a water route to China could be found north of Canada, the so-called Northwest Passage. Smith's theory was that somewhere north of Virginia, a major river connected the Atlantic to the Sea of Cathay. Remember, the Sea of Cathay is the Pacific Ocean, and we know how wide that is. But that was the dream of all these merchant traders. And you have to remember, they were doing this for business reasons, because the riches of the East were very valuable, the spices and other things. Europeans didn't have those spices until they brought them back from the Middle East and the Far East. So I'm going to stop for a minute now and just think about that, about Henry Hudson, who is very famous, but he really was a failed Arctic explorer. And I'll continue the story when we come back from our break. So this is the Heritage Radio Network. This is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist. And remember that our sponsor today is TechServe. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with my program called The Naturalist on the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant in beautiful downtown Bushwick. And I started to talk about Henry Hudson because this is the 400th year celebration of Henry Hudson's discovering of the Hudson River. So far we haven't really reached the Hudson River yet, so we'll continue our voyage. Okay, so The new theory was that China could be found north of Canada, okay, and the so-called Northwest Passage. And Smith's theory, remember we spoke about John Smith, was that somewhere north of Virginia, a major river connected the Atlantic to the Sea of Cathay, and that was another name for China, Cathay. This is a case of people hearing only what they want to hear. Smith's Chinese Sea was presumably the Pacific Ocean. It was. But rivers are not known to flow from one sea to another. Remember, rivers usually flow downhill. And for a river to flow across North America, it would have to climb mountains. And that's kind of difficult for a river to do. So Smith's theory was based on statements from northern tribes who trapped for fur. They talked of an ocean that could be reached from a river. They probably said nothing about Cathay, China, which was an obsession of the Europeans and not the North Americans. It seemed likely that the North Americans were talking about how they could travel up the Hudson and follow the Mohawk tributary. Well, if you've ever gone upstate New York, you know that the Mohawk River feeds into the Hudson River somewhere up. Oh, if you follow the Thruway, and when it starts to go west north of Albany, you come to the Mohawk River. So let's get back to the story. Okay, and follow the Mohawk tributary, and with a short land portage for a canoe, because they didn't have any 70-foot wooden ships, these Native Americans, they had canoes. For a short land portage, and a portage means you have to take your boat out of the water and carry it a distance and then put it back in. That's what a portage is. okay, for a canoe and arrive at the Great Lakes. So, standing on the shores of Lake Erie, one can have the impression of being on the coast of a vast sea. Lake Erie is so huge that you can't see the other side of it. So they thought that that was the edge of the continent, and then that was the big ocean. Furthermore, the currents of the Hudson are so multidirectional that the salty ocean water travels so far inland that, according to Indian legend, the first inhabitants came to the Hudson in search of a river that ran two ways, as though it flowed into the seas at both ends. Okay, whether it's such a the early Indian explorers, spoke about this, and whether it existed was just in their limited experiences. So the European came looking exactly for that. But what the Indians meant by a river that runs in two ways was that the Hudson River is a tidal estuary all the way up to Newburgh. So when the tide comes in the Hudson from the ocean from New York Harbor, it runs up the river. And actually, you can take a boat, or if you're in a canoe or a sailboat, you can just, it's very easy paddling up the Hudson when the tide is coming in. And you could ride the tide all the way up to Newburgh, or in some cases of a full moon and a spring tide, which means the tide is very high, the salt water goes almost up to the dam near Troy. And that's 150 miles from New York City. So that's what the Indians meant. And then when the tide reversed and the tide went out, it went out down the river and back through New York Harbor and back out to the ocean. So that's what the Indians meant about a river that flowed both ways. And that's what I said, I think, before. They had a name for it, which it's hard for me to pronounce, something like Mullahituck or something like that. So the Europeans thought that that's what the Indians meant, that the river goes two ways and it ends up at another river. Hudson, the out-of-work explorer, had something to sell, a possible new passage to China. The Muscovy Company had listened and voted against the project. Remember, that was his former employers. But Britain's new and fast-growing competitor, Holland, was interested. The Dutch had formed the Dutch East India Trading Company, and they had sponsored voyages going the other way, down south of Africa, around the tip of Africa, and then going to the Indian Ocean, all that. So they were certainly interested in a new shorter route. So this Dutch East India Company, abbreviated VOC, hired him. The Dutch were not interested in new theories from John Smith or Henry Hudson. They hired Hudson to search for the Northwest Passage, a route through the ice floes north of Russia. So remember now, they're going to go north from Holland, around England and up to Russia, around Scandinavia, and then go east, and they thought that they could get to Cathay or the Orient that way. So the ice floes north of Russia. Hudson had no faith in this northeastern theory, but the VOC, that's the Dutch company, gave him a commission with a new ship, and so he took it and sailed north until well out of view of the Dutchman, or out of Holland. Then he picked up a westerly gale and crossed the Atlantic thousands of miles on the opposite direction of his orders. So remember, they hired him to go north from Holland and turn east and try to get around Russia and through all that ice. But he knew that that was impossible because he had tried it once before. But he didn't tell them that. He said, give me a ship and I'll find you a route to Cathay. So he sailed thousands of miles in the opposite direction of his orders, and he reached North America, the North American coast, off Newfoundland. And you know, Newfoundland is off the coast of Canada. So they were pretty far north. So now we're going to talk about John Cabot, who was an earlier explorer. More than a century after John Cabot's voyage, this was a well-known route because John Cabot had found Newfoundland and Nova Scotia many years before. Hudson then followed the coastline south to Cape Hatteras and the mouth of the Chesapeake, within miles of his old friend, John Smith at Jamestown. But sailing in a Dutch vessel, he didn't visit the British settlement because they were really enemies, the Dutch and the English at that time. Perhaps he needed to locate John Smith's Jamestown to find his bearings on Smith's map. Then he then began exploring the coast, the coastline for a river to China. So remember now, he came across the Atlantic, the Newfoundland, and went south following John Cabot's charts. And then he had the charts of John Smith, and he passed by the entrance to the Hudson because he went south almost to Jamestown because he had to orient his position according to the maps of John Smith. And he didn't visit John Smith because, as I said, England and Holland were at war, and he was sailing in a ship with a Dutch flag, the Half Moon. So I'll continue this story when we come back from our break. So this is Bernie Wides, The Naturalist, and we're going to take a short break now, and then we'll return to the Henry Hudson's quest for a passage to the Orient. Okay, this is Bernie Wides. We're back on the air. This is the Naturalist program. And we left you hanging in the Atlantic Ocean, sailing south along the North American coast, heading towards Jamestown. But as I said, the British and the Dutch weren't too happy with each other, so he wouldn't sail into Jamestown, which was an English colony. So he just did that to orient himself. So, because he was using the maps of John Smith. Okay, so he began exploring the coastline for a river to China. In this search, he became the first European to enter Delaware Bay. But seeing the shallow waters, shoals, and sandbars at the mouth of the Delaware, Hudson felt certain that this was not a great river, great enough to cut through North America to China. He continued on, viewing the forest lands of an unknown continent off the port side of his boat. So if you know anything about boats, about the left side of a boat is called the port side, the right is the starboard. So he was sailing north, so the left side of his boat was facing land, the Carolinas and New Jersey. So it's called the port side. Okay, so here he is sailing north, and it seemed uninhabited because he didn't see any people. They were watching him, but he never got a chance to see them, with only an occasional bird for counterpoint to the rolling surf that he kept seeing along the shoreline on sandy beaches and the creeks in the that were emptying into the ocean. Then rounding a flat, sandy, narrow peninsula, today accurately labeled Sandy Hook, Hudson and his men, almost as if they were falling through a keyhole, found themselves in another world. So here he is. He sailed up the coast of New Jersey to Sandy Hook, which, if you know the map of New York Harbor, is at the entrance to New York Harbor on the western side. Sandy Hook sticks out from New Jersey right below Staten Island. Okay, so he's at Sandy Hook, and his men, almost as if falling through a keyhole, found themselves in another world. The wide expanse of water, 100 square miles, lay flat, sheltered by the bluffs of Staten Island and the rolling hills of Brooklyn. Sandy Hook on the port side and the shoals of the Rockaway Peninsula on the starboard side, an ideal barrier furnished with several channels protecting the opening. When they looked into the water, they could see large schools of fish following them. This was the place. From all directions, they saw rivers pouring into the bay. If there were a chasm in the heart of North America, opening up a waterway all the way to China. This is what it would look like. So Hudson identified three great rivers when he entered the bay, and they were probably the Raritan Bay, which separates New Jersey and Staten Island, the opening to the upper Hudson, and the Rockaway Inlet on the Brooklyn-Queens side on the shore of Long Island. That's Jamaica Bay. He had not yet sailed through the narrows between Staten Island and Brooklyn, not yet seen the Upper Bay, the Hudson River, the Harlem River, and the East River that connects with Long Island Sound. He had not yet even seen the lush, green, rocky island of ponds and streams in the middle of the estuary. And that island is Manhattan. Hudson sent a landing party ashore on Staten Island. It was late summer, and the plum trees and grapevines were bearing fruit. Immediately upon landing, as though Hudson's crew had been expected, as though they had been invited, people dressed in animal skins appeared to welcome them. These people in animal skins saw that the leader of the people who arrived on the floating house wore a red coat that sparkled with gold lace. In what became a New York City tradition, commerce instantly began. The Europeans in red had hand tools, while the skin-clad Americans offered hemp, beans, and a local delicacy, oysters. The Europeans thought they were getting much better value than they were getting, but the Americans may have thought the same thing. They were getting tools, and the Americans were getting all this great fresh food and hemp, which they used to make rope in those days. It's not the kind of hemp that you smoke. It's the hemp that's used for making rope and line on vessels. Hudson and his men had no idea with whom they were trading. They reported that the people in skins were friendly and polite, but could not be trusted. These people, the Europeans distrusted, called themselves the Lenapehocking, the land of the Lenape people. The Lenape thought they knew their visitors. They were a people called in their language, which I can't pronounce, Shawinak, which meant salty people. The grandparents of the Lenape who saw Hudson may have seen an earlier salty person, the Italian Verrazzano, sailing the coast with his crew for Francis I, King of France, in 1524. So this was 1609. So Verrazzano found the entrance to New York Harbor in 1524. Verrazzano had chosen to moor his ship off Staten Island, further up than Hudson, in the narrow opening that bears his name and where Staten Island is now connected with the Verrazzano Bridge. So Verrazzano could see the second interior bay with its wide rivers and well-placed islands and described the bay as a pleasant lake. And we passed up with our boats only into the said river and saw the country very well peopled. The people were almost like all the others, clad with feathers or fowl or skins, and they came rowing and rowed to us cheerfully, making great shouts of admiration, showing us where we might come to land safely with our boat. But what happened was, when Verrazzano didn't get really credit, because the winds shifted, forcing the Europeans, remember they were in sailboats, with great reluctance to return to the ship and sail on. So they sailed back out of New York Bay and went on further adventures. This was probably the first sighting of salty people by the inhabitants of the harbor, although their grandparents may also have seen Esteban Gomez, a Portuguese explorer who passed this way on his way up the coast of North America, and he was looking for codfish. And that's another story about codfish. But the Portuguese discovered the huge schools of codfish off the North American coast. And early Portuguese maps, well, you know, we're going to run out of time, so I'm just going to tell you that Hudson and some of his men landed, and they were greeted nicely by the Indians, and they asked about directions, and the Indians told them about a great lake that was up north. So he started to sail up the Hudson River. They explored the upper harbor, then chose the river west of the island of Manhattan and sailed up what is now called the Hudson as far as what we now call Albany. From there, it must have been clear that the river was narrowing and not the lead to China that they expected. So Henry Hudson discovered that the Hudson River really, in truth, is only 315 miles long. They only got up to Albany. So they got up the river about 200 miles, and they found it shoaling and getting very shallow, and they knew that this was not the route to China. So whatever happened to Henry Hudson after that? Well, he had been exploring for years. So he sailed back down the Hudson and decided to go north along the coast of Canada. And he did. He went all along the coast of Canada until he rounded the tip of New Brunswick and the Canadian Maritimes, and went into a bay, which is now called Hudson's Bay. And he got stuck in the ice there because winter came on. Remember, he came into New York Harbor in September. But winter was coming on rapidly up there, and his boat got frozen in the ice. And they spent the winter frozen in the ice in Hudson's Bay. And the Indians kept them alive by trading them, giving them food and helping to keep them alive. But come spring, Henry Hudson wanted to still keep going west to find the Northwest Passage to China. But his men revolted because they had become sick and tired of his obsession. And they revolted and they had a mutiny. And they took Henry Hudson and his son and some of the men that were sick and put them in one of the ship's longboats and left them there with minimal supplies. And the men took the boat back to Europe, where they were tried for mutiny, but it wasn't much of a big trial. So what Henry Hudson ended up, he ended up dying in Hudson's Bay, because I'm sure they starved to death or they were killed by the Indians. And nobody ever knows what happened to Hudson. But this year we celebrated the 400th anniversary of the discovery of the Hudson River by Henry Hudson. And we even have a city in New York State called Hudson, New York, which at one time almost was the capital of New York State. So this is the end of that story. And you might say, why is a naturalist telling this? Because of the treasures he found in New York Harbor estuary. The hundreds of different kinds of fish and the oysters and the clams and the mussels. That was the true treasure in North America. And Manhattan, which I'll talk to another day, was a beautiful place to live at that time, with rolling hills and streams and salt marshes and plenty of food for everybody. And I've been quoting from a book called The Big Oyster, The History of New York on the Half Shell by Mark Kalansky.